Hey guys, welcome back. It's me, Michelle, and I am so glad you're joining me again today. After last week's intense, heavy story, Chris Watts, the piece of shit Chris Watts, I thought I'd lighten it up with some just good old-fashioned ghost stories today. Ghost stories can be so fun. You know, people, they fear what they don't understand. And these things, these happenings, they make you think. They think about, you know, makes you think about your surroundings, all that stuff that goes bump in the night and freaks you out. And, you know, whether you believe in ghosts or not, it's still fun to hear these kind of chilling tales. And as I mentioned before, my husband and I actually used to lead a paranormal investigating group. And I would say that I label myself as the skeptic. We had a range of different personalities and talents in the group, including this one girl that really made me think twice about the way I think about mediums and people with the ability to feel and see things. I wouldn't normally believe in that, but she actually made me scratch my head on more than one occasion. You know, we'd go into an investigation and we'd always keep the background and all of that, all the information from her. She didn't know anything. And she would walk in and pick up on things that we hadn't told her yet. So it was pretty impressive. We had another guy that was actually on one of the Ghost Hunters shows, the Ghost Hunters Academy. And he went on to another one of the shows. And then he eventually was doing some of the ghost hunting tours at the Stanley Hotel for a while, and now he's off to, you know, bigger and better things. Pretty impressive. He was pretty awesome. So, you know, those investigations, they really aren't as glamorous as they seem on TV. They're very time-consuming, and in some cases, just a waste of time. I remember one time my husband, he got called to a place where the lady was freaked out and scared, and it was kind of like, you know, emergency situation. And one of the things that she said was, she stated that the faucet kept turning on by itself, or it had turned on by itself, you know, freaked her out. And so upon arrival, she was already like 12 packs in, which, you know, in case it's not super obvious, alcohol and drugs can be a huge factor in whether or not you're actually experiencing something paranormal or not. But after being there a bit, the water did turn on by itself because her cat jumped across a pile of dirty dishes and hit the faucet and turned it on. So that one was debunked. Anyways, honestly, there was things I saw and heard and smelt that I can't explain for myself. And of course, you can hear things from people and be expected to believe them. But until you actually see things for yourself, I think that's what makes people strong believers in paranormal activity. Now, I saw things on our investigations that I can't explain, but at the same time, I don't know that I can say with certainty that it was paranormal. Maybe it was. Maybe after trying to debunk something and coming up with no logical reason for it to happen, maybe it was a ghost. But I am the type that still says maybe. Some ghost hunters, their tactics are to label something paranormal if it can't be explained. I think there's some things that seem more strongly paranormal than others. For instance, when I witnessed things moving and investigated it and tried to debunk it, and there was no outside factors like a vent or a breeze, and yeah, I mean, maybe. I can't explain it, but that doesn't mean I'd necessarily label it paranormal. But when something seems to interact with you, for example, like you request something to be moved or turned on and it does, or you ask a question and you get a response, those things hold a little more validity with me. So, you know, the shows on TV, they're entertaining, but again, they are TV. So if nothing's happening, you have no show. So I think there's probably a little nudge at least to get things going. But let's go now to a few places around the world that are deemed some of the most haunted places. Stephen King said, "Any big hotels have got scandals, just like every big hotel has got a ghost,
Why? Hell, people come and go. Sometimes one of them will pop off in his room. Heart attack or stroke or something like that. Hotels are superstitious places. No 13th floor or room 13. No mirrors on the back of the door you come through. Stuff like that. The Stanley Hotel has been called Disneyland for ghosts. I love this place. I've been there. I haven't stayed there, but I have visited. In case you don't know what I'm talking about, it's the Shining Hotel, where Stephen King got his inspiration for the book and eventual movie. So they've got this cool little museum set up downstairs. They have a miniature maze set up outside, like in the movie. And it's just a beautiful place. The hotel is just really cool. And Estes Park is where it's at. And that, just in general, is a beautiful place. It's a great place to visit if you ever go. Just, you know, the little town, all the little shops in town. And then right outside of town up on a hill is where the Stanley sits. And it's right there in the Rocky Mountains. Beautiful place. And we used to go there several times a year when we lived in Colorado. And then the film Dumb and Dumber had some scenes there at the Stanley. And Jim Carrey stayed at the Stanley while he was filming Dumb and Dumber. But he only lasted 3 hours. So let's talk about the Stanley. The Stanley earned a reputation as paranormal before Stephen King even arrived. The history of the hotel, it was completed in 1909. As an elite 420-room retreat. Freeland Oscar Stanley was an American inventor, entrepreneur, hotelier, and architect. He made photographic plates, which made him a multimillionaire, and with his twin brother, Francis Edgar Stanley, he created the Stanley Motor Carriage Company. The Stanley Steamer was a steam-powered automobile with a top speed of 127 miles per hour, which made it the fastest vehicle on Earth at the time. F.O. Stanley and his twin brother were born June 1st, 1849. So tomorrow's their birthday. Happy birthday, Freeland and Francis. They were the second and third born of seven children in Kingfield, Maine. Kingfield, Maine has a Stanley Museum that showcases the steamer invented by the brothers. And interestingly enough, you can adopt a Stanley steamer at the Stanley Museum. You choose a car in the collection and you adopt that car for 1 year. They put your name on the stand in front of the car for all to see and admire, and you will receive an adoption certificate, and your name will also be listed on the website. You can also have your adoption in memory of or in honor of anyone you choose, and the yearly fee is $100. Sorry, guys, had to pause there for a second. Once again, dog trying to bust through the door to get into me. So I had to take care of that business for a minute. So let me continue with the story. 1903, at the age of 54, F.O. Stanley was given less than 6 months to live due to tuberculosis. The doctor recommended fresh, dry air, sunlight, and a healthy diet, but he would likely be dead before summer's end. And like many with the same diagnosis, called lungers, Stanley and his wife headed to the Rocky Mountains. It was not an easy trek from Massachusetts, but his doctor promised to come in September to bring Stanley's body for burial. He and his wife, Flora, arrived in Denver in March of that year. His Stanley runabout was shipped out as well by train. They stayed their first night in the Brown Palace, which has its own history of being haunted. That's another really cool building. It's like in downtown Denver. Few little stories from the Brown Palace. The main hotel's dining room, called Ellington's today, was once known as the San Marco Room, where big bands played, and later the band San Marco Strings entertained the hotel guests. One night, after an employee heard strange sounds coming from the room, he walked in to find a formerly dressed string quartet practicing their music. Stunned, he said to the musicians, "You're not supposed to be here."
only to hear their nonchalant reply, "Oh, don't worry about us. We live here." Another employee encountered an apparition, a man dressed in old-fashioned train conductor's uniform, appearing just for a moment. Then he disappeared through a wall. The spirit was seen at the current location of the airline ticket office, which once housed the railroad ticket office.
Okay, guys. Sorry, I had to pause again. I am back. Because of the bulldog that you may or may not hear. Again, I have to apologize every episode because of my dogs. So she's in here with me. So again, you may or may not hear some heavy breathing in the background. It's just coming from my bulldog. So she'll settle down here in a second. Okay, so the Brown Palace, another report says there's a frequent sighting of a uniformed waiter in the service elevator. There's cheerful children who are known to gallop in the hallways. A baby cries often in the boiler room, which that's kind of weird. Anyways, moving on, let's go back to Stanley. So he initially saw a doctor when he got to Denver, who recommended he leave the hotel for a rented house. And after the winter passed with no improvements on his condition, he decided to head up to the mountains. His doctor recommended Estes Park, whose climate, he said, was comparable to that of Davos, Switzerland, where there was a posh resort for European tuberculosis. On June 29th, Flora took a train and Stanley took off in his steam car for Estes Park. He did get lost on the way, and he stayed a night in Boulder, so he was a day late. They stayed in a primitive cabin the first summer that they rented. Within just a couple of months, Stanley was hiking 5 miles a day and nowhere near death at all. Naturally, he fell madly in love with Estes Park, with the valley. The area gave him a second chance at life, and he decided to return every summer. When he first got there, he looked like the Walking Dead. He was 5'11", tall, weighed 118 pounds. So he had 1 foot in the grave. Just 4 years later, he was completely recovered and in the best shape of his life. And he actually lived to be 91 years old. By the end of 1903, he bought some property. He built a cottage with 4 bedrooms, a modern kitchen, a basement for all his hobbies, which would be billiards, violins, and steam cars. So the basement had a billiard table, and there was a detached garage for a violin workshop and a turntable so the steam car could exit without backing up. And that home is still standing today west of the Stanley Hotel as a private home. 1907, he was determined to turn Estes Park into a resort town, so he began construction on the famous Hotel Stanley, wanting to cater to the wealthy upper class. He also built a hydroelectric plant up in the mountains so the hotel could be all electric. He even had phones in every room. The hotel had 48 guest rooms, each pair sharing one bathroom. It had a fully electric kitchen and steam laundry, a hydraulic elevator, and electricity throughout. The main hotel and concert hall were completed in 1909. The concert hall had a Steinway grand piano, which was a gift to his wife. Guests that arrived by train were ushered to the hotel by a fleet of specially designed steam-powered vehicles called mountain wagons. The Stanley was a summer resort, so heat wasn't even added until 1979. Guests would enjoy golf, bowling, horseback riding, and motor excursions during the day. And at night, they enjoyed a formal dining hall and concerts and billiards. So, like I said, F.O. Stanley was from Kingfield, Maine. And if any of you are fans at all of Stephen King, which I am a huge fan of, you would know that he's from Maine as well, and a majority of his stories are set in fictional Maine towns. So the towns that Stephen King lived in
born in Portland, Maine, near Portland, Maine, was actually less than 2 hours south of Kingsfield. And he lived in Bangor, Maine, which is about an hour and 40 minutes east of Kingsfield, where Stanley was. So let's talk about Stephen King for a second. In the 1970s, the Stanley Hotel was experiencing a downward spiral. Its splendor had faded, and with other accommodations with more modern amenities like heat and air conditioning, it was taking most of the business elsewhere. It had a reputation already of being haunted, which wasn't really a choice selling point back then. The Stanley seemed doomed for the wrecking ball until 1974, when a horror author checked in with his wife. That fateful night would not only elevate the literary horror genre and set Stephen King on his path of greatness, but it completely altered the destiny of the Stanley Hotel. At this time, King was struggling with his latest project, Darkshine. He was looking for an isolated setting for the novel, and locals suggested Estes Park for his inspiration. So him and his wife heard about the Stanley and wanted to check it out. They found themselves the only guests that night, as the next day the hotel was closing for the season. They were served dinner in an empty room with chairs on every table but theirs. Tabitha retreated to their room, number 217, while King wandered the long empty corridor, listening to canned music and visiting the bartender in the hotel bar. The Stanley Hotel's remote location, grand size, and eerie desolation had King's imagination running wild. He even claims, "It was like God had put me there to hear that and see those things." In a retelling about that night, King says, "I dreamed of my three-year-old son running through the corridors, looking back over his shoulder, eyes wide, screaming. He was being chased by a fire hose. I woke up with a tremendous jerk, sweating all over, within an inch of falling off the bed. I got up, lit a cigarette, sat in a chair, looking out the window at the Rockies, and by the time the cigarette was done, I had the bones of The Shining firmly set in my mind." You may notice that in Kubrick's 1980 film of The Shining, the famous bathtub scene takes place in room 237. That's because the Timberline Lodge in Oregon, which is where they did the exterior shots for the film, they did not really embrace the ghosts quite like the Stanley Hotel does, and they asked that the number be changed to a non-existent room number. And the movie was a huge success. But it's pretty well known that Stephen King actually was not a fan of it. He didn't like how Jack Nicholson, he didn't feel like he was the right person for the role. And Stephen King wrote the character's descent into madness as a slow, more surprising plummet. But Nicholson portrayed it kind of more from the beginning. He totally captured the guy, captured who that character was. He was great, brilliant, loved him in the role, but that's not what King pictured, and it's not really how it was originally, like in the book. That's not the character, how it's portrayed. And then Kubrick also portrayed Wendy as a blubbering weakling, not to mention the emotional torture that he put the actress through, Shelley Duvall. And if you're a Stephen King fan, you know that it's well known he writes strong female characters. And Wendy should have been, was in the book, but was not in the movie. I'm not a huge fan of Shelley Duvall in this role. I don't think the acting was on point. Love the movie. Don't like her acting in it at all. She was kind of the blubbering weakling, honestly. Here's an interesting tidbit, though. The scene in which Wendy was swinging a bat at Jack, that's a prime example of the stress that she went through on set. That scene actually made it into the Guinness Book of World Records because it took 127 takes, the most for a scene with spoken dialogue. It caused her to have a breakdown on set. Her throat was hoarse, her hands were wounded, and she was dehydrated from crying so much. So,
1996, when they did the miniseries on TV, King made sure that the filming happened at the Stanley where his whole story began. There's actually a little version of the Stanley that is there. It's like a miniature playhouse that you see like down in the area where the museum and stuff is. At least that's where it was when I was there. Anyways, so let's talk about some of these ghost sightings at the Stanley. One of the more well-known ones is Elizabeth Wilson, who was the Stanley Hotel's head chambermaid. And on July 25th, 1911, she was nearly killed in an explosion. The hotel had lost power due to a storm, and she was asked by the manager of the hotel to go throughout and light the lamps, which was their backup source for light. What no one knew at that time was there was a gas leak in one of the rooms. Gas didn't have a scent back then. So when she opened the door to room 217, her open flame ignited the gas and essentially blew the room apart and sent her through the floor into the room a story below. She broke her ankles. It said that Stanley paid her medical bills, which, you know, nowadays that's called workman's comp. But anyways, it took 3 hours to free her from the rubble. Wilson continued to work there until 1951 when she died in her sleep. But some say that her spirit never left. And that was the room that Stephen King also stayed in when he was there, 217. So apparently, the ghost of Elizabeth Wilson, she likes married couples, but unmarried couples who dare to share a room may find that they have Wilson as a chaperone for the evening. She has been known to climb into bed in between the unmarried couple, trying to force them apart. Guests have reported items moved, luggage unpacked, and lights being turned on and off. Now, the Ice House is where Billy spends his afterlife. Billy was once a kind, shy boy with dark brown hair. In photos, he appears only as a misty figure. He allegedly shares the Ice House with the spirit of another gentleman who sports a large, bushy beard and white hair. The hotel also has a pet cemetery, which existed well before Stephen King's version of Pet Cemetery. Here is the grave of Cassie, a golden retriever. Guests report hearing Cassie pawing at their doors, eager to deliver the morning newspaper. Comanche, a white fluffy cat whose spirit is said to wander the property, is also buried there at the Pet Cemetery. Room 401, a male ghost, who some believe to be an Irishman named Lord Dunraven, is reported to be in this room. Although he never visited the hotel in life, as it was built 20 years after he left Estes Park, it was built on the land he once owned. In the closet, women feel their hair being played with, an arm around their shoulder or waist, or a hand moving up the back of their leg. Men don't feel particularly welcome in this room sometimes, and they have felt someone is pressing them into bed or their jewelry disappears. This was the room where Jason on the Ghost Hunters, the television show, had his drinking glass that was set on the nightstand next to him implode while he was sleeping. The closet door also opened and closed on its own. In room 407, people have reported being tucked in their room. A little boy said that he kept kicking his covers off and they kept coming back up throughout the night. His mother was quite shocked and said that she hadn't woken during the night and certainly did not keep covering him up. Another guest reported feeling someone sit on the edge of the bed, but when she turned the light on, no one was there. She did, however, see an indentation as if someone had just gotten up. In room 418, ghost children do mischievous things in this room. Covers are sometimes removed during the night, and hangers are known to move on their own. Bathroom lights have also been reported to turn on and off on their own. A little girl, about 4 years old, and her mother stayed in there a while back. The following morning, the little girl reported being tickled by a little boy during the night. She wasn't afraid, though. Instead, she simply told the little boy to stop, and he did. Room 217. Many housekeeping events happen in this room. Guests have reported returning to their room after dropping off their bags and finding their luggage has been unpacked for them. Other guests have also reported their shoes being lined up neatly at the end of the bed. Shadows have also been reported passing through the wall, as this room was once part of a much larger suite until the mid-2000s. Room 302, a male ghost has been seen as a shadow in this room, walking near the walls. Photos have been known to fly off the wall, and Grant from Ghost Hunters had a table levitate while he was changing film, if you saw that episode. Room 413, several guests have reported seeing a man dressed in old-fashioned clothes standing in the corner of the room. The face of a man in a blue ball has also been seen on the outside door of the room. The concert hall also is a hotspot of paranormal activity. Paul worked at the Stanley from 1995 to 2005 and died of a heart attack while en route from the hospital after suffering chest pains. Known as a jack of all trades, one of Paul's responsibilities was to enforce the hotel's 11 p.m. curfew. It's not uncommon to hear a faint and ominous "get out" in the after hours, though it's unclear if he'd be so bold as to shush hotel founder Flora Stanley, who can often be heard playing the piano some 7 decades after her demise. A construction worker sanding the floor one night believes Paul was brazen enough to physically nudge him to the door after feeling two arms pull him back. Paul is also known to flicker the flashlights of touring groups. Lucy also wanders the concert hall, tampering with lights and lifting spirits. She's been known to actively communicate with and answer questions from staff and parapsychologists via flashlights, but her story and pre-death connection to the Stanley remain unclear. They think that she was a runaway, a homeless girl that was found there, and then she was kicked out and she froze to death, and they think that's who that was. But whatever her history, employees insist Lucy's presence and distant humming lightens the energy and mood whenever she lingers. Eddie, who initially presented himself with a foul odor, earned him the nickname Stinky Man. Apparently offended by this moniker, Eddie switched tactics and began exuding a more pleasant smell. His presence, however, seemed to cause discomfort, possibly due to a life of hardship, according to visiting psychics and mediums. He has since lightened up, but remains the resident prankster and apparently a ladies' man, often suspected of stroking the hair and kissing their cheeks of female guests. Eddie has no known connection to the property. It is wondered if Lucy and Eddie are simply a new demographic of guests. And it raises the question of travel in the afterlife. So let's jump the pond now to another super haunted place. Raynham Hall in Norfolk, England. The Brown Lady of Raynham Hall is a ghost that reportedly haunts Raynham Hall in Norfolk, England. It became one of the most famous hauntings in Great Britain when photographers from Country Life magazine claimed to have captured its image. The Brown Lady is so named because of the brown dress that she wears. According to legend, the Brown Lady of Raynham Hall is the ghost of Lady Dorothy Walpole, the sister of Robert Walpole, generally regarded as the first Prime Minister of Great Britain. She was the second wife of Charles Townshend, who was notorious for his violent temper. The pairing was Townshend's second marriage, and rumor had it that Dorothy had once been the mistress of a Lord Wharton, a royal playboy. According to legend, when Charles discovered Dorothy's secret love in 1725, he locked her in Raynham Hall, telling everyone that she had died, and he even held a mock funeral. When in reality, Dorothy roamed the halls of Raynham Hall as a solitary prisoner, suffering until her death from smallpox in 1726. The first recorded claim of a sighting of this ghost was by Lucia C. Stone at a gathering at Raynham Hall at Christmas of 1835. Stone says that Lord Charles Townshend had invited various guests to the hall, including a Colonel Loftus, to join in the Christmas festivities. Loftus was, and another guest named Hawkins, said they had seen the brown lady one night as they approached their bedrooms, noting in particular the dated brown dress she wore. Colonel Loftus was walking to his room late one night when he saw a figure standing in the hall in front of him. The figure was wearing a brown dress. He tried to see who the woman was, but she mysteriously disappeared. The next week, Colonel Loftus again saw the figure. This time, however, he got a better look at her. He said she was an aristocratic-looking woman. She was wearing the same brown satin dress, and her skin glowed with a pale luminescence, but to his horror, her eyes had been gouged out. Colonel Loftus told others of his experience, and more people then came forward to say that they too had seen a strange figure. An artist drew a painting of the Brown Lady, as she was now known, and this picture was then hung in the room where she was most frequently seen. The following evening, Loftus claimed to have seen the Brown Lady again, later reporting that on this occasion he was drawn to the specter's empty eye sockets, dark in the glowing face. Loftus' sightings led to some of the staff permanently leaving Raynham Hall. The next reported sighting of the Brown Lady was in 1836 by Captain Frederick Marriott, a friend of Charles Dickens and an author of a series of popular sea novels. It is said that Marriott requested that he spend the night in the haunted room at Raynham Hall to prove his theory that the haunting was caused by local smugglers anxious to keep people away from the area. In 1891, his daughter Florence Marriott said this of her father's experience. He took possession of the room in which the portrait of the apparition hung, and in which she had been often seen, and slept each night with a loaded revolver under his pillow. For 2 days, however, he saw nothing, and the third was to be the limit of his stay. On the third night, however, two young men, nephews of the baronet, knocked at his door as he was undressing to go to bed, and asked him to step over to their room, which was at the other end of the corridor, and give them his opinion on a new gun that just arrived from London. My father was in his shirt and trousers, but as the hour was late and everybody had retired to rest except themselves, he prepared to accompany them as he was. As they were leaving the room, he caught up his revolver. "In case you meet the Brown Lady," said, laughing. When the inspection of the gun was over, the young men in the same spirit declared they would accompany my father back again, in case you meet the Brown Lady, they repeated, laughing also. The three gentlemen, therefore, returned in company. The corridor was long and dark, for the lights had been extinguished, but as they reached the middle of it, they saw the glimmer of a lamp coming towards them from the other end. "One of the ladies going to visit the nursery," whispered the young Townsends to my father. Now the bedroom doors in the corridor faced each other, and each room had a double door with a space between, as is the case in many old-fashioned houses. My father, as I have said, was in a shirt and trousers only, and his native modesty made him feel uncomfortable,
So he slipped within one of the outer doors, his friends following his example, in order to conceal himself until the lady should have passed. I have heard him describe how he watched her approaching nearer and nearer through the chink of the door until, as she was close enough for him to distinguish the color and style of her costume, he recognized the figure as the portrait of the brown lady. He had his finger on the trigger of the revolver and was about to demand it to stop and give the reason for its presence there when the figure halted of its own accord before the door behind which he stood, and holding the lighted lamp she carried to her features, grinning in a malicious and diabolical manner at him. This act so infuriated my father, who was anything but the lamb-like in disposition, that he sprang into the corridor with a bound and discharged the revolver right in her face. The figure instantly disappeared. The figure at which for several minutes three men had been looking together, and the bullet passed through the outer door of the room on the opposite side of the corridor and lodged in a panel on the inner one. My father never attempted again to interfere with the Brown Lady of Raynham. On September 19th, 1936, Captain Hubert C. Provand, a London-based photographer working for Country Life magazine, and his assistant, Indre Shira, were taking photographs of Raynham Hall for an article. They claimed that they had already taken a photograph of the hall's main staircase and were setting up to take a second when Shira saw a vapory form gradually assuming the appearance of a woman moving down the stairs towards them. Under Shira's direction, Provand quickly took the cap off the lens while Shira pressed the trigger to activate the camera's flash. Later, when the negative was developed, the famous image of the brown lady was revealed. The account of Provand and Shira's ghostly experience at Raynham Hall was published in Country Life magazine on December 26, 1936, along with a photograph of the brown lady. The photograph and the account of its taking also appear in the January 4th, 1937 edition of Life magazine. Shortly thereafter, the noted paranormal investigator Harry Price interviewed Provand and Shira and reported, "I will say it once I was impressed. I was told a perfectly simple story. Mr. Indre Shira saw the apparition descending the stairs at the precise moment when Captain Provand's head was under the black cloth. A shout, and the cap was off, and the flashbulb fired, with the result which we see now. I could not shake their story, and I had no right to disbelieve them. Only collusion between the two men would account for the ghost if it is a fake. The negative is entirely innocent of any faking." Some critics, however, have claimed that Shira faked the image by putting grease or a similar substance on the lens in the shape of a figure, or moved down the stairs himself during the exposure. Others claim that the image is an accidental double exposure, or that the light somehow got into the camera. Joe Nickel has written that a detailed examination of the photograph shows evidence of double exposure. John Fairley and Simon Welfare wrote, "There's a pale line above each stair tread, indicating that one picture has been superimposed over the other. A patch of reflected light at the top right-hand banister appears twice." The magician John Booth wrote the photograph could easily be duplicated by naturalistic methods. Booth had the magician Ron Wilson cover himself in a bedsheet and descend the grand staircase at the Magic Castle in Hollywood. The faked ghost image looked very similar to the Raynham Hall photograph. Other critics point out that the image of the lady very closely resembles that of the standard Virgin Mary statue that would be found in any Catholic church. The light patch covering the bottom one-third of the image resembling the inverted V shape, being very indicative as the outer garment above it drapes down on either side at an angle. Also, the head is covered and the hands appear to be together as in prayer. And the square or rectangular pedestal on which she stands is also clearly visible. This strongly suggests that the photo is simply superimposition of the Madonna statue onto the empty staircase. So, who knows? I'll post the picture for you guys. You guys look at it yourself and you know, tell me what you think. So, since 1936, there has been rare sightings of her. But that may be due to the fact that she has reportedly also been seen at Sandringham House. So it could be that she is simply choosing to spend her time there instead. FYI, that is the home of Queen Elizabeth II. And there she seems to appear as her young, happy self, whereas in Rainham Hall, she appears as the eerie, aged brown lady. All right, let's jump over to Paris. Buried underneath the streets of Paris lie the Paris catacombs, housing the bones of over 6 million people. Created due to a shortage of burial space in the city, the Paris catacombs have become one of the eeriest sites in Paris. The history of the Paris catacombs started in the late 18th century when major public health problems tied to the city's cemeteries led to a decision to transfer their contents to an underground site. Here are a few tales that come from the catacombs. The uncovered video camera. This, by far, is one of the creepiest Paris catacomb stories. In the early 1990s, a group of acataphiles, those are people who study and explore the Paris catacombs regularly, and illegally, might I note, were walking through the dark chambers of the cemetery. They happened upon a video camera on the ground. To their surprise, the camera had footage on it. As the group watched the footage, they heard disturbing noises. It became apparent that the man holding the video camera was lost and had no idea how to escape. In the video, the audience can clearly draw that the man is going mad inside the underground network of tunnels. The video ends abruptly with the man dropping his camera on the ground. To this day, no one knows who this man was or if he came out alive. Many believe that the movie As Above, So Below was inspired by this tragedy. Also, the legends say that if you are inside the Paris catacombs after midnight, the walls begin to speak. Disembodied voices will try to persuade you to venture deeper and deeper into the catacombs until you can't find your way out. During the French Revolution, a man named Philibert Abstart was a doorman at the Val de Grace Hospital. On a mission to fetch a certain liqueur from the cellar, Philibert actually ended up entering the Paris catacombs instead. Walking around the pitch black catacombs alone with just a single candle, Philibert became incredibly lost and confused. Many believe he may have been intoxicated at the time as well. Philibert's candle blew out, making his vision completely black. At this point, it was virtually impossible for him to escape the profound darkness of the catacombs. His body was not found until 11 years later, when a group of cataphiles uncovered it. They identified him by the hospital key ring hanging from his belt. Philibert is buried in the catacombs in the exact same place where he died, with a tombstone describing his death. Cataphiles and catacomb folklore tellers say that each November 3rd, Philibert's ghost haunts the labyrinth of the catacombs. 2004, a group of police officers were exploring a part of the Paris catacombs restricted from the public access, and they began to uncover very strange things. First, they found a PA system with pre-recorded guard dog barking noises playing. Then they found 3,000 square feet of galleries wired for phones using pirated electricity. The officers found a bar, living area, workshop, lounge, and even a cinema with room to seat 20 people. The cinema seats had been carved into the stone of the catacombs. The creepiest part was they saw cameras on the ceilings recording them. The police squad went back to the area a few days later with a large team to further investigate. Everything they had discovered, from the phone lines to the Paris Catacomb cinema, had vanished. The only thing they found? A note that read, "Ne cherchez pas," meaning, "Don't search," or "Forget it." And I probably totally said that wrong because I know absolutely nothing about French. I apologize. Okay, let's go on to another cool place. We're going to go back to America, and we are going to go to Florida. We're going to go to St. Augustine Lighthouse. At St. Augustine Lighthouse, the ghosts have taken their job of guiding weary travelers so seriously that it seems they have decided never to leave. Do the lightkeeper ghosts leave a light on, beckoning you to visit? St. Augustine is considered the oldest city in America, and it beckons visitors with its historic charm, dominating fortresses, and even an archaeological park that claims to be the original location of Ponce de Leon's very own Fountain of Youth. If you're visiting St. Augustine, you might already know that it's considered one of the most haunted cities in America. But are you brave enough to meet its ghosts? If you are in search of a ghost adventure, you need only to follow the light. Literally. The history of St. Augustine Lighthouse dates back to 1589, when very old maps detailed Sir Francis Drake's raid on the coast. There, on Anastasia Island, was a mention of a wooden watchtower. Built to support the nearby Castillo de Marcos, this watchtower survived numerous changes of hands. Each new conqueror had their own particular idea of not only how the tower should function, but of its design. They added to it, they then took those additions away, and then added them again. And throughout this constant redesign, the watchtower saw its share of epic battles. Take the HMS Industry, which sank in 1763, taking along with it all of the iron and axes and grindstones Britain had sent over to use in building the new American colonies. Or how about 16 ships that wrecked on one very rambunctious New Year's Eve, fleeing the aftermath of the Americans' victory in the Revolutionary War. Then there are the more eccentric stories, like those of pirate invaders, or that of a Spanish captain who cut off the ear of an accused smuggler. The lighthouse, as seen today, was built after the fall of the South in the Civil War. Concern grew over the state of the tower. Was its position the most strategic? Was the worn-out lighthouse, which has gone through one remodel too many, going to fall into the ocean? Luckily, funding was granted to build a new lighthouse nearby the original site in 1874. The new tower soon saw its own share of woes, though. Take the World War II era, when the coast was rife with German U-boats prowling the coastline. St. Augustine's lighthouse is so steeped in a violent maritime past, it's no wonder the ghosts have decided to take up permanent residence there. But what is it they're trying to tell you? One of St. Augustine's lighthouse's most famous ghost is that of lighthouse keeper Peter Rasmussen. Known for his careful watch over the tower, Peter also adored the finer things in life. It seemed keeping up with modern luxuries was of utmost importance to him, so he ensured that bathtubs, closets, and lavatories were installed in the keeper's house. But if there was one thing that Peter loved more than any, was his cigars. And it seems his desire for the finer things continued into the next life. for if you were to visit St. Augustine Lighthouse and the lighthouse keeper's quarters, you might begin to wonder, do you detect the scent of cigar smoke? Is it Mr. Rasmussen still watching over his beloved lighthouse? Or what about the ghost of another lighthouse keeper, Joseph Andrew, who fell to his death from the top of the tower when the scaffolding used to complete the paint repairs failed? Apparitions are often tied to places where they met their sudden death. Is Joseph Andrew still in the lighthouse, trying to sort out why he was taken from this earth so unexpectedly? You can still hear the screams of a man falling to his death. The most famous ghosts of St. Augustine Lighthouse, however, are those of Eliza and Mary, the daughters of Hezekiah Pitty. He had been hired to carry out construction work and repair on the St. Augustine Lighthouse and used a cart to carry his wares back and forth. Riding the cart down to the water was a favorite pastime of the Pitty children. They used the cart as a Victorian-era roller coaster, riding the cart to the water and bringing it back up to the site and riding it again. Only a wooden board at the end of the rail stopped the cart from tipping over into the water. On July 10, 1873, the three Pitty sisters, Mary, 15, Eliza, 13, and Carrie, 4, along with an unknown African-American girl, who was 10, whose father may have worked on the site, were riding in the cart as normal. The wooden board that stopped the cart from going into the water was not in place. The cart carrying the girls flipped into the water, trapping the girls underneath. Mr. Dan Sessions, a young African-American worker, witnessed the tragic event and raced to the water. When he reached the cart, using all his strength, he lifted it from atop the girls. By this time, three of the four girls had drowned. The only survivor was the youngest, Carrie. In the days after the accident, the construction site, as well as the town, shut down for the funeral of the girls. Following the funeral, the Pitty family returned to Maine to lay their daughters to rest in their hometown. Staff researchers have not yet been able to find the final resting place of the young African-American girl. The young girls seem to be at play to this day, for the sounds of their laughter echoes throughout the hallways and the grounds of the lighthouse. These playful specters don't mean to frighten you, they merely want to play a game with you. One story involves a relief lighthouse keeper living in the home in the 1950s who reported hearing footsteps upstairs. He went to investigate, but no one was up there. The head keeper at the time was James Pippin. He served from 1953 to 55 and was the last keeper to live at the light station. Pippin initially lived in the keeper's house, as all the previous keepers had done, but he moved to a much smaller 1941 coastal lookout building, swearing that the big house was haunted and he would not stay there another night. In 1955, the lighthouse lamp was fully automated and the United States Coast Guard replaced lighthouse keepers with a position called lamplighter. The local lamplighter had all the duties of a lightkeeper, but they did not live on site. As a result, the keeper's house was rented for a time. A local man who crafted leather goods rented the property during the 1960s. He tells the story of waking up one night with a small girl standing by his bed. As he blinked his eyes to look at her, she disappeared. In 1970, after standing empty for many years, the keeper's house burned under mysterious circumstances, gutting the home, leaving only the basement and a few charred timbers. St. John's County purchased the shell of the building with the intention of demolishing it for safety reasons. However, 16 women in the all-volunteer Junior Service League of St. Augustine stepped in, raising $1.2 million over the next 15 years to restore and renovate the Keeper's House, the Lighthouse Tower, a feat never before accomplished. The group added the building to the National Register of Historic Places with the help of Karen Harvey, a local historian, writer, and longtime lighthouse advocate. During the renovation, both construction workers and the JSL volunteers reported numerous unexplained incidents in the home. The basement was a particularly active area for ghostly encounters, being the only part of the home that had not completely burned. Perhaps the children liked to play here. Today, you can still feel a spooky presence there. As playful spirits, the girls enjoy playing hide-and-seek sometimes, including unexpected people. One night, in the dark lighthouse tower, a long staff member was closing up for the night. He heard giggling at the top of the tower. Thinking that he had left someone at the top of the tower, he returned to find it empty. As he began to head back down the tower, he heard the same giggling below him. Descending to the bottom, he once again found no one there. Was it just the wind? Or was he in the midst of a game of hide-and-seek? Another evening, a female guest on a Dark of the Moon tour was standing on the first step of the metal lighthouse staircase. When she took her first step to climb the tower, she found her shoelace tied to the staircase. Whether it was a ghost or her companion playing a trick on her, we cannot say. The girls sometimes appear to people in fully formed apparitions. Several years ago, during the day, a guest was exploring the maritime hammock trails and came upon a young girl in a Victorian outfit, sitting on a bench reading a book. She began to ask the girl a question. Another group came up from the opposite direction. Distracted by the group, the woman looked away for only a moment and turned back to find the little girl on the bench gone. In a similar instance, a woman on a ghost tour approached another woman to compliment her daughter's behavior on the tour. Confused, the woman said she had no daughter. The other woman then told her that a little girl had been standing by her side most of the evening. There were no children on the tour that evening. So, there you have it. Just a few spooky places around the world. There's so many more, but I just chose a few of my favorite and most interesting. I've only visited one of them, but I would love to go see all of them. You know, believe in ghosts or don't, but the thought of something lingering around, watching you, maybe even touching you, trying to communicate with you, maybe wanting to do you harm, or maybe wanting a friendly interaction, whatever the case may be. The fact is, there's no proof, but it's fun to think about. I like getting chills and goosebumps from these ghost stories. It's just fun. So, once again, thanks, guys. Thanks for joining me. And next week, we're going to get back into something more serious topic. Not as fun as the ghost stories, but we're going to dive into a mysterious death of a Hollywood star. So, I will see you next week. I am posting pictures on Instagram and Facebook of these haunted places we talked about today. If you want to contact me, it's followthedarkpodcast@gmail.com. And I will talk to you guys next week. And until then, you know it. Stay dark, my friends.